After these introductions I've had today, I can hardly wait to hear what I'm going to say. And I have jotted down a note or two, but if I ever needed inspiration, the help of the Lord, this is the time. Because Brother Moyle wasn't expected home till the 21st, and he was home yesterday. So I thought, well, this assignment's off. Brother Moyle will take care of his own assignment. But he went to California yesterday, too. So here I am. Learning to live better through better use of vocational opportunities. Now, I don't know what that means to you, but to me that means that man has the right to work, he has the right to choose a vocation, and he has a right to work at the vocation he chooses. Now, I'm afraid sometimes that we are losing some of those rights. In the Declaration of Independence, we read that we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator, with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. In other words, the government of the United States is instituted to preserve unto us the right to pursue happiness. Now, that doesn't mean that we have a right to have happiness thrust upon us. The government wasn't instituted for that purpose. It was instituted to preserve unto us the right to pursue happiness. Now, how do you pursue anything? You chase it, don't you? You go after it. You seek it. You don't sit down and wait for happiness to come to you. Because there can be no true happiness, of course, if we just sit supinely by and become wards, so to speak, of any agency or any government. Our fundamental right, as declared here, is to pursue happiness, and the government must preserve that right unto us. So genuine happiness, of course, comes only when we go after it. Nothing of us is of great value to us when we don't work for it, when we don't struggle for it. Now, a vocation has two meanings. A vocation is a call or a summons. I think we can understand that in this church. I don't think it's a church in the world that does so much calling and summonsing as this church. And it also means an occupation, a profession, or employment. Now, what are our vocational opportunities in this church? In the welfare plan, we are supposed to work. We are supposed to be helped in our choosing our work. We have employment counselors. We have work directors. We have bishops. And the bishop is charged by revelation with seeking out the poor. Now, I don't know whether God intended that poor meant only those who were in need and didn't have security. I have an idea he meant that the poor were those who were in need of anything. And it's the duty of the bishop to seek us out when we are in need, whether it be in need of food, in need of a roof over our heads, or in need of employment. Then he's to seek us out. And he can call on other agencies to assist him. And in our great welfare program, we have an organization than which I've never heard of one better, theoretically anyway. And it would be perfect if it had the sustaining influence and support of all the people of the church. I was being interviewed on the radio down in Auckland, New Zealand on one occasion, and on the same program was a Mr. Ball of Cleveland. He was the head of the Social Security Committee of the city of Cleveland. And after the program, he asked me if I would go along with him to his hotel. And as we drove along, he started asking me questions about the welfare program of this church. He said, "You've solved it. You know how to do it. We've tried in Cleveland. We've spent millions, but we haven't succeeded. But you people have." Of course, I answered that question the way I always answer questions such as that, that you can't understand our program unless you join us. It's impossible to understand this church, really understand it, unless you're a member of it, because you can't have the spirit of it unless you're a member, and if you don't have the spirit of it, then you don't have a full understanding of the program of the church. Now in our church, we have what we call the green card system. You people know anything about green cards? You know whether or not your bishop has a green card, which tells all about you and what you can do and what you can't do, and the number of children you have in your family and so on? Well, you know, I thought I was going to do something. Have a little fun with Brother Moyle. I checked up to see if they had a green card on Brother Moyle. Do you know what Brother Moyle's profession is? Other than what he's in now? He's a lawyer. He's one of the great lawyers of this state, one of the most successful. But I never knew before, until I checked his green card, that he was a carpenter. My, what an opportunity for better living through his vocation as a carpenter. Then I learned, too, that one day they called him up down in his ward before he moved into the ward he's in now. He's living out in the country. And they were building a welfare building of some kind out there. And they called up Brother Moyle and says, "Brother Moyle, come on over Wednesday afternoon at 5 o'clock and bring your carpenter's tools." He says, "Carpenter's tools?" He says, "Yes." "How did you know I had carpenter's tools?" He says, "It's on your green card that you're a carpenter." Well, he was over there and helped them put the roof on that building. Is there anything wrong with that? No, of course not. I don't know whether the bishop has a green card on me or not. But when I get home, I'm going to check up, and I'm going to see if he's got everything on there I want him to put on. Because believe it or not, I'm a cook. And I doubt if that's on my green card. Greater opportunities for living, to live better, through better use of vocational opportunities. Well, I love to cook. I kind of stopped it lately because I sample everything I cook. That doesn't help my diet. But nothing would please me more than to have my bishop call me up and say, "Now here, Brother Cowley, this is an emergency, but we have a sister up here with a family of children. The husband's an invalid, and she has to be with him all the time. How about you coming up and cooking the dinner for the next 3 nights? I don't know how long that invalid would last, but I'd be glad to go up. I'd be glad to go up. That'd just thrill me to death. Isn't there something you people would love to do that you're not doing? I was out in one of the stakes one day when we were doing it. They were gathering all these clothing to send to Europe. And the Relief Society sisters were assigned certain projects of making certain things. And I went out to this stake, and I talked with the Stake Relief Society president. And I said, "How are you getting along?" "Oh," she says, "we've got our assignment, our budget all built up." I said, "Well, this is a little early. You're supposed to spread it over the year." And she said, "Oh, no, this is an emergency budget. This is for the people in Europe." "Oh," I said. She says, "we've got it all, and then some." I said, "Well, now, how did you handle this?" She says, "I got the names of all the sisters in the stake who are playing bridge, who go to their bridge meetings and their social functions in the afternoon. And I went around and called on every one of them. I never said anything about them playing bridge. Never even mentioned it. I gave them each an assignment of sowing in this project. And there wasn't one that refused me. And she says, Brother Cowley, they've all sowed themselves right into activity in the Relief Society. I think that kind of comes under this heading, learning to live better through the use of better use of vocational opportunities. That was a wonderful vocational opportunity, wasn't it? Now, about the call. What do you do when you're called to do these things? Here was Relief Society sister. She went out and called these people. She never said, now here, you shouldn't be wasting your time playing bridge and so on like that. No. She went out and called them to do something. They couldn't turn her down. They couldn't turn her down. I wonder how many of our people that are who are called to get into some vocational activity, who are not now in it, will respond to the call. You may know of the sister down here in one of the stakes in central Utah who is on relief, receiving sustenance from the state. The stake president went around to her and says, I want you to work. I want you to earn your living. She was 77 or 78 years old. She says, what do you mean? I can't work. I'm too old. Oh, yes, you can. I've got a job for you. And you're the one I want. She says, what's the job? She says, I want you to be my private secretary, stake president. She says, well, what do I have to do? He says, you'll have the time of your life. I'll bet I can't get you to leave the job once you take it. She says, what is it? He says, I'm going to give you a list of all the meetings that we hold. And the names of all the people who are supposed to be at those meetings. And I'm going to give you their phone numbers. And all you have to do is call every one of them up on the phone. Remind them of the meeting. Don't take any excuses. Be sure that they're there. She said, well, I haven't got a telephone. Oh, well, we furnished the telephone. So he made a plan for her. And she got on the job. Said she'd never had so much fun in her life. She said, I just call them up and tell them they can't turn me down. They can turn the stake president down, but they can't turn me down. Here she is earning her own living, and they've had the best attendance down there at those meetings they've ever had. And she's earning her way. She's pursuing happiness. It isn't being thrust on her. Now, of course, we have a lot of people who are not able to work. Oh, we have to give them happiness. The best we can do. The best we can do for them. But some of us don't do that. Some of us even put that responsibility onto others. And so we don't accept the responsibility. We don't accept this vocation of taking care of our kith and kin who are in need of help. Now, you know what Christ said to Mary, the mother, almost his last words when she was down there with John the Beloved. And he looked down and he saw her. And he said, woman, behold thy son. And then he said, son, behold thy mother. And then these are the next words. From that very hour, the beloved son took her to his home. You see, John knew what he wanted, what the Master wanted. Behold your son. Son, behold your mother. I don't think we're doing enough of that in our church. Mothers are not beholding their sons. They're beholding some agency or government organization which has nothing to do with their sons. And the sons are not beholding their mothers. And so as a result, we break down the integrity of the family. I was in Canada one day, 4 or 5 years ago, and I went to the home of a bishop for dinner. He had wanted me to stay at his home, but he didn't have room. But I went to dinner. When the dinner was all set, he went into a room, came out carrying a little woman. Lovely little soul, white hair. He took her over and he placed her down gently in a chair at the table. Then he took a serviette and put it around her neck, pushed the chair up close. Then he went back to the room and he came out with his arm around an elderly man, a little white-haired man. And he took him over and gently placed him at the side of the woman. Then he took a serviette and put it around his neck, or napkins, we call them. And then we all sat down. And then he said to me, "Brother Cowley, this is the reason we don't have room for you. These are the parents of my wife, and we're trying to get even with them while they are so helpless for what they did for my wife when she was a helpless child. And before that man and his wife took a spoonful of food, they fed the lovely parents. They couldn't feed themselves. Woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother." Can you think of anything more beautiful than that? Then, in contrast, I go to a home in Salt Lake City to see a relative of mine. Catholic home for aged women. I went in to call on her. She just broke down and wept, pled with me to call on her children and see if one of them wouldn't take her to his home. She died there. She had given most of what she had acquired, and she was a woman of considerable wealth, to her children. She died there with the cross above her head. The Catholic sisters waiting on her. "Woman, behold thy son. Son, behold thy mother." Now, is there any way we can live better? As sons. Than by accepting the vocation, the call, the summons, as John did. To bless those who are near to us, to whom we owe so much. Now, of course, our mothers are very peculiar sometimes. My, they get independent. You even find the type that won't let their children help them. I had an aunt like that. She died about 2 years ago. The last of my grandfather's 25 children. 90 years old. Living alone, helping herself. I'd go in to visit her and she'd say, "Don't you talk to me about getting off government relief." I'll say, "No, I won't say a word about it. It won't be long now. That problem will all be solved." Won't say a word about it. But you know, if her nephews had contributed 25 cents a month to her, she'd have been getting $500 a month. You'd take 25 children. They're down now to about the third or fourth generation after her. They multiply fast. And you get 25 cents from each one of those. But you know, the one thing that really pleased me about her, and I used to tell her about it, I used to say, "The thing I'm happy about with respect to you is the fact that when you die, the state will bury you, not your family." My, I'm proud of that. That just makes me feel good. To think that your own blood won't bury you. It'll be the state. She knew what I was talking about. She had taken enough out of her relief money and put it aside to pay for her burial expenses. And so when she died, the state buried her. That is something for me to be proud of, isn't it? And I come around here and talk to you people about these things. And I have a situation like that. It's over now, just like I told her. It's over with now. But see, brothers and sisters, I think it's like I said this morning. I meant to say it if I didn't. You can't live if you don't love. There's no way to live without loving. Life isn't worthwhile without it. Like I said about Brother Lund's family. Every single day, those grown boys, great big overgrown fellows, with wives and children of their own, were back at their mother's home. back there making her life happy, taking her food. Woman, behold thy son. Marvelous. Well, what about the priesthood quorums? I've always maintained that if we had the proper integrity in the priesthood quorums that we should have, that all our problems would be solved. Because this is the priesthood of God. There isn't anything God can't accomplish through his priesthood. And so if we had the integrity of the quorums, which we should have, we wouldn't have to worry about our security. My wife wouldn't have to worry about her security when I'm gone. And I'll tell you what I mean. I have a good example of it. Over here in Colorado once, I was at a state conference, and I asked one of the elders quorum presidents how they were getting along as a quorum. We talked things over. I said, "Do you do anything to help one another?" "Oh, yes, we don't do bad." I said, "Well, what are you doing?" He says, "Well, I can tell you this." He says, "We've got a member of our quorum in the hospital down in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Strong, he was a strong, vigorous young man, buying a beautiful farm, hard worker, lovely little family, and he was just going ahead, paying off his bills and his mortgage. All of a sudden, he was stricken." Well, ordinarily, that had been the end of the farm, the end of the security for the family. But the elders' quorum president said to me, he says, "That was our loss, as much as the loss of his wife and children. So we took over, and we've gone out and we've operated that farm. He doesn't take much time with all of our tractors and equipment. We all get together and we operate his farm. The mortgage is paid off. They have good income from the farm. All he has to worry about is getting well down there in that hospital. Is there anything wrong with that system?" "No, I don't think so." Now, talk about integrity of the quorum. Quorums are organized. I wonder how many men go to their quorum presidents for counsel and advice. I have men come up to me and talk to me about business. I know nothing about business. I always say, "Have you talked to the president of your quorum?" I wouldn't care if he was a deacon, that's what I'd ask you. "Have you talked to the president of your quorum?" They always say no. Why not? You belong to the priesthood of God and you have a president. He's entitled to inspiration. Why not? An elder holds the priesthood of God to 70, high priest. I was talking to Brother Moyle about this one day. We were snowed in up in Canada together. This is before he was a member of the Council of the Twelve. We were talking about the integrity of priesthood quorums. And he said to me, he says, "You know, I've never entered into a business deal in my life without consulting the president of my priesthood quorum." I said, "Brother, he's the man I want to meet. Who is he?" Brother Moyle, with all his wealth, he says, "Well, it doesn't matter who he is." I said, "Well, now, what kind of counsel have you had in business matters from the president of your quorum?" I says, "Why, you're the man I'd come to if I wanted business advice. I wouldn't go to the president of your quorum or my quorum either. I'd come to you." And he says, "Well, that's wrong." I says, "Well, have you ever had any good counsel from your quorum president?" He said, "Yes." He says, "I was going into a business deal once with a friend of mine, a man didn't belong to the church. We couldn't miss. We couldn't lose. We knew we could make thousands. I went to my high priest quorum president and put the whole thing on the table. Told him what I was going to do, and he says, 'Now, I want some advice.' The quorum president said just what I said to him. 'Well, Brother Moyle, if I wanted business advice, I'd come to you. You have no business coming to me.' 'Oh, yes, I have. You're the president of the quorum of the priesthood of God to which I belong, and I have a right to come to you for counsel.' And then the president said, 'I'll give you some counsel.' Brother Moyle says, 'What is it?' 'You go higher up and get your counsel.' So I did," he said. "Finally found myself sitting down opposite President Penrose, counselor to the president of the church. And I told him what I'd done. And I told him I'd been sent higher up, and here I am, President Penrose. And this is the deal. And he explained the whole thing to him and told him who the man was that was going in with him. Brother Penrose looked at him. He says, Brother Moyle, I'm not a good business counselor. Brother Moyle says, well, if that's all you got to say, that's it. That releases me. I can go ahead and do as I please. But then he said to him, Brother Moyle, that man you're going in business with, he doesn't belong to the circle over which we have any influence. Brother Moyle says, that's all I want to know. He dropped the whole thing right there. He learned that he shouldn't be going to a man for counsel in the priesthood of God when he was going in business with a man over whom that priesthood had no influence. Now, I don't think Brother Moyle's ever lost anything by doing that. Well, I know I'm not talking to the right people here. You wouldn't be here. It's always the case. When you want to talk things over with people, they're generally away. It's just like the man came in to see me the other day, and he was intoxicated. Anybody comes in the building intoxicated, they send him to me. I give them a lot of time, too. I try to keep them so long, they'll sober up. This man wanted me to do him a great favor. He didn't belong to the church. He wanted me to do him a favor. I says, well, I'd be glad to do it if you're here, but you're not here. I says, what's your name? And he told me. And I says, will you go out and see him and tell him to come in Monday sober? Come in Monday sober so I can talk to him. Well, he never came back. He told me he wouldn't. I know why he didn't come back, because he isn't sober. He hasn't sobered up. He's an alcoholic. But you know, you can't talk to a man like that. Because when you talk to a man under the influence of liquor, you're injuring someone who's absent. You're injuring a person who's absent. You see, so the way it is with us in the church, we're generally talking to the ones who are absent, not the ones who are present. Well, now I can leave you my testimony, brothers and sisters, about the welfare opportunities in this church. I don't know a great deal about the mechanics of this welfare work, but I've never had a spiritual impress, a spiritual manifestation about the truth of anything stronger than I've had about the truth of the welfare program of this church. This is God's plan of economy. There isn't any question about it. I think I jotted down a passage of scripture here, a song. I have been young and now am old, yet have I not seen the righteous forsaken, nor his seed begging bread. There's a lot of truth in that. The psalmist had never seen the righteous forsaken, nor the children begging bread. A man or a woman's righteousness should be the insurance for their security. And if this church doesn't have the power and the means, the program for saving people materially as well as spiritually, then this church does not have the power of God unto salvation. Micah, the prophet, he said, they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken it. They shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree. That's good security, isn't it? Security for every individual. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to be picked up and go placed under a fig tree or under a vine. Those vines and fig trees have to get there some way. They have to be planted. They have to be husbanded. Culture. They have to grow and develop under the direction of those who sit under those vines and under those fig trees. Brothers and sisters, if we in this church really had the spirit of the genius of this program, we would be happy. We would be happy. Now, I said this one day somewhere, and someone sarcastically, after meeting, was in Salt Lake, said, "Yes, but look at all those Cadillacs up behind the church office building. What kind of security is that?" I wish they only knew about those Cadillacs up behind the church office building. I want to tell you right now, there's no one in this church who is more welfare-minded and who are actually on a welfare plan more than the authorities of this church. It disturbs me no end when people talk to me about these positions and say how wonderful they are. Well, they are wonderful. It's God's work. But I'm telling you, everyone is giving his life for this work. Look at Brother Bowen, been lying on his back now for just 1 year, partially paralyzed. One of the greatest lawyers this state ever had. Man of great income. And one morning, President Grant came by his home up on B Street, says, "Bert, jump in and ride down to conference with me." And on the way down to conference, he says, "You're through practicing law." And he gave up his profession. His producing capacity was just wiped right out. From the standpoint of material wealth. And he placed on the altar everything that he possessed, his health and his vitality included. Look at President Clark, greatest international lawyer in the United States, man who aspired to great heights in the diplomatic field. International law, who became ambassador of the United States to Mexico. Prior to that, the personal counsel to Mr. Dwight Morrow, one of the Morgan partners. I don't know whether it's true or not, but I have heard that Mr. Morrow paid him $5,000 a month, and he must have done, for being his personal counsel while Mr. Morrow was ambassador. Because he had to give all of his time to Mr. Morrow. And then when President Clark was right at the peak of his career, what happened? Vocation came along. A call, a summons. And he withdrew himself from everything that he had been doing, which he enjoyed doing, and from which he aspired to do. To do what? To be your humble servant and mine. And Brother Moyle, all of them, all of them. I wish they had cars better than Cadillacs to travel around in. Because they live in those cars. They live in strange homes and sleep in strange beds. I know what they do. And you can't tell me that men like President Clark and President McKay and President Stephen Eldridge and all these men, myself excepted, I'm a little different. Never did have anything. So I haven't given much. But
when I see those men and I'm sitting by them in the council and I hear their testimonies and hear them pray, I'm telling you, brothers and sisters, they are on the welfare plan of the church. They are living in accordance with God's plan of economy. I'll never forget the day I heard one of him after he'd received the charge when he was ordained to the council. One of the wealthiest ones there, he stood up and he said, "Everything I own, everything I possess, all my securities, all my wealth is on the altar. Take it." So no wonder I get annoyed when somebody says sarcastically, "Look at those Cadillacs." "Well, when you go out of here, go over and look at my car. I got one of those fancy Studebakers, European design, Chippewa green, whatever that means. Beautiful, beautiful. I drive down the street and I suppose people say, 'There goes my tithing.' I wish it were their tithing. I wouldn't hesitate to take a car paid for by the tithing of the people. Not on your life. I can't produce any wealth. It's impossible." But they're not telling the truth, even though I wish they were. There's one thing they can't say. They can't say, "There goes my fast offering." They know that. And I have a new car every year, brothers and sisters. Brand new car every year. Every kind of a gadget on it you can put on it. It doesn't cost me a penny. Because I've got a friend that knows I'm on the welfare plan. And every year he calls up and says, "I've sold your car. Come down and get another one." Never any transfer of money. I went out the other day to an appliance store in Salt Lake. I was looking for an upright freezer. I got to start storing food, so when this hailstorm comes, I'll be prepared. So as I was looking around, the good brother that owns the place, and the reason I went out there is because I knew he was a good Latter-day Saint, and I knew every employee in the place was an honest tithe payer. So I went out to patronize him. And I was looking around, he says, "What are you looking for, Brother Cowley?" I says, "I want to get an upright freezer." So he walked around with me, and finally we came to a beautiful one, and he opened up, and he says, "There's a nice one." I said, "My, that is a beautiful one, isn't it?" He says, "Yes." He said, say, "Would it offend you if I gave you that?" I said, "Full or empty?" Well, the next afternoon it was up in my home, and he brought it himself. He didn't send his men to do it. He brought it up himself. Well, offend me? I should say not. I'm on the welfare plan. You can't offend me. Now, if he looked at my green card and said he'd like me to come out and cook a meal sometime, I'd be glad to do it. Glad to do it. And he'd probably send me home with a car full of stuff to put in the freeze. Well, brothers and sisters, the spirit of this thing we need. That's what we need. The spirit of it. The genius of it. God grant that we may have this. Use every opportunity you see for doing something. And you're supposed to be happy. If you're not happy in your work, there's something wrong with you, or else there's something wrong with your work. Now some of us can acquire a spirit of happiness in our work, even though we don't like the work at first. Now, for instance, I never aspired to this kind of work. I never wanted to be a minister of religion. Oh, I've always wanted to be a church member, be a good Latter-day Saint. But I've never wanted a job in this church. My background hasn't been the kind of a background to get me to go out and work, give my full time to church work. No, I worked my head off through law school, try to be a lawyer. That's what I wanted to be. But I had to believe in vocations, calls, summons. I told my wife when we were on our way home from New Zealand, My, isn't this wonderful? We're released now. We can relax. All we got to do is go home and sit on the back row in the chapel and sustain the bishop and everybody, the deacons, quorum, presence, and all of them. Just sit back and relax. That's what I wanted to do. And practice law. You see. But I had to respond to a vocation, to a summons. Now, oftentimes I think, my, there are other things I'd rather be doing than this. Then I repent of that. I repent of that. Because there's great satisfaction in helping your fellow men, or trying to. I tell you how this, I use this welfare plan to a fare thee well. Fare thee well. We have an alcoholic rehabilitation center in Salt Lake, you know. And every few months I go to the welfare committee and I insist on them sending food over to that alcoholic rehabilitation center. And we feed those drunks. You know why we do it? Because 65% of them belong to us. They're our people. They may be drunks, but they're our drunks. Why, you don't know what good you're doing, brothers and sisters, when you're in this welfare work. You just can't imagine it. Now, as a result, as you see, I'm the best friend the drunks have in Salt Lake. They come to me for counsel, but I don't talk to them unless they're sober, because they're not there. I can't waste my time. But my, we're all God's children. He wants us all to have security. Sit under our own vines, our own fig trees. He doesn't want to see the righteous begging for bread, nor their seed. No. Righteousness is the best security we have, the best insurance for it. And in this church, righteous people are entitled to security. They're entitled to be happy. They're entitled to be placed in employment where they can be happy. They're entitled to do the thing they're best equipped to do. And when this thing has worked out in 100 or 200 years from now, when it's actually worked out to perfection, I'm telling you, we will be the happiest people in all the world. We won't go home at the close of a day weary and worn out from doing something we didn't like to do. But we'll all be doing that which we are equipped to do. And this great plan will bring these things about. I thank God for those who are in need. I thank God for the poor. I thank God for the downtrodden, for the sinners, because it's a challenge. It's a challenge to all of us who are more fortunate. And we should be close to those who are in need. Now, I apologize for Brother Moyle's absence. No one knows the welfare plan any better than he. He was in it right from the beginning. As I said before, about all I know about it, brothers and sisters, is that it's good to be on the receiving end in this program, and that I know the spirit of it. It started back in Genesis, when Joseph built the bishop's storehouses for Pharaoh. That's where it started. And when Joseph sent for Jacob and his brethren to come over there, when they were in need. And when they came, Pharaoh, I guess, says, let them have anything they want. And Joseph said, no, these men are shepherds. And what did Pharaoh do? He gave them a welfare project. He says, give them the land Gideon. And so they went and worked the land Gideon. They just didn't sit around and receive help. They didn't become wards of Pharaoh and the Egyptian government. They became self-supporting and self-sustaining because the opportunities were given them to pursue happiness. God grant that that right may never be taken from us, that we may always have the urge to pursue it and not sit supinely by and wait for it. I pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.